In Parshas Noach, the central narrative, of course, is the flood. There's a great flood. It's over. Noach comes out. Hashem promises he will never bring such a flood again. And as a sign, of course, Hashem notes the rainbow. Hashem says, Hakibaki Mosi es brisi etchem, I will uphold my covenant. I will never again exterminate humanity. There will never be a mabul. Hashem says, Zos os habris asher ani nosim b'ni uveinechem. This is the sign of the covenant between you, between all living things. Es kashti nasati ba'anan, my bow I shall place in the clouds. I have placed in the clouds. V'hoysel os bris b'ni uvein haaretz. That will be the os bris, the sign of the covenant. And Hashem goes on, he says, V'haya ba'anani anan al haaretz, when I have clouds, when clouds come, I'm threatening to again bring a deluge. V'nirasa keshes ba'anan, there'll be a keshes, there'll be a rainbow. V'zacharti es brisi, and I will remember my covenant, not to bring a mayim l'mabu l'shaches kol basar, not to bring another deluge. Again, V'haysa keshes ba'anan, the bow will be in the clouds. Risiha, we'll see it, Liskar bris olam bein elokim uvein kol nefesh chaya, and so on. That is the bris, that is the keshes. Again, zosos habris. The Torah reiterates many times, there's a bris, there will be no more deluge, and there is a keshes, a rainbow, as a sign of this promise. Now, there's a basic question which Jewish commentators have been dealing with at least as far back as the early medieval period. As we'll see, some of the Christians apparently have been struggling with this hundreds of years earlier even. Some of the Oriental Christians, people with names like Ishodad and Isobarnun, and I don't know who these people are. I don't think anyone has read them for about 1,000 years. The only copies I could find are like the original Syriac online, which I can't read. But there's a basic question that people have been grappling with for centuries, which is the rainbow is a physical phenomenon. Now, obviously, our understanding of optics today is different from the medieval or the pre-medieval or the ancient classical Greek understanding of optics. But as we'll see, both according to our understanding of physics and optics, as well as according to the medieval one, the rainbow is understood to be a physical phenomenon. Many commentators assume, those who hew to a more naturalistic approach, typically assume that the rainbow would have been something that would have appeared before the flood. Also, rainbows are just part of the world. They're understandable based on the ordinary laws of physics. This wasn't some kind of new supernatural sign that God places in creation after the mabul. So what exactly does it mean for the rainbow to be a sign of anything? More generally, we have to understand, how is the rainbow a sign? What does it mean? How does the rainbow represent God's promise? What's the point of it to begin with? But I'm particularly interested in the kind of philosophical question, how does the rainbow serve as a sign? Isn't the rainbow a scientific, naturalistic, physical phenomenon? Now, of course, this is kind of a particular example of a much broader question, which Jews, religious people in general, have been grappling with for millennia too, which is, how do we reconcile a religious understanding of nature with a scientific, naturalistic one? The question obviously is a broad one. We're just going to kind of scratch on the surface tonight. But tonight we're going to look at this question in the specific aspect of the rainbow. What exactly is meant by the Torah stating that God is now placing the rainbow as a sign? Isn't the rainbow a purely naturalistic, purely physical phenomenon? That certainly is one approach. That certainly is an approach offered by some commentators, that even though God says, I'm now placing my bow, he doesn't mean now. He means God is simply revealing an aspect of his creation that he had planned. God knows the future, of course, and he had originally built the world. And so that's certainly a possibility. Yeah, I don't mean the question is unsolvable. That's certainly one approach. But as we'll see, not everyone was happy with that. So we'll just kind of go through some of the different approaches to the rainbow. So just a little bit on the physics of the rainbow, just to understand what we're talking about. Again, the modern physical understanding of the rainbow is not so relevant here, because this is almost certainly not the way any of the early thinkers would have understood it. But and again, I am no expert on physics. This is just from some very cursory reading. But basically, rainbows, as we understand them today, are caused by light reflecting and refracting through raindrops, through water vapor in the air. When light hits objects, one of three things happen to it. It can be absorbed, it can be reflected, it can be refracted. Absorbed means it just goes in there and adds energy to what it hits. Reflected is what we know in a mirror, bounces back. Refracted means it keeps going, but basically, in layman's terms, it means the light gets bent. You can discuss things like phase velocity changes and wavelength changes. But basically, in simple terms, as far as I understand it, it just means that the light gets bent. Now, we know that white light is made up of a spectrum. White light is not actually white. It's a combination of a continuous spectrum of different colors across the visible spectrum. When the light gets refracted, you get different. The light gets split into its component parts. We often have 7 colors. There's nothing really special about 7. It's more a linguistic thing than anything else. The colors are really continuous, more or less. We kind of arbitrarily, based on the way our eyes work or the way our minds and linguistic centers work, we break them up into different colors. And basically, the light gets broken up into a spectrum of different frequencies, which appear as different colors. Newton did this, I think, in his prism experiment. People did this in prism experiments. They still do that, and you know, kids do that in school. You shine a light through a prism, a white light, you see it spreads into a spectrum of colors. That is essentially what happens in a rainbow. The procedure is a little more complicated. There's both refraction and reflection. The sun will be behind the observer. The light goes through. It hits the raindrop. Some of it gets all the way through. We don't care about that light. Some of it gets refracted on the way in. Refraction occurs when light passes between two different mediums, which have different refractive indexes, like air and water in this case. Light gets bent, it bounces off the back of the raindrop, comes out again, gets refracted again. Basically, it's a combination of refraction and reflection. It gets split into its component colors. Why it looks like a bow, where the sun has to be, what the angle is, these are all questions you have to know the math. It's, you know, basically just trigonometry. It's nothing particularly complicated, but those are all details. They're a little bit beyond my pay grade here. I didn't have enough time or to go through all of it, but basically the way we understand it, it's, you know, simple reflection and refraction. It should be noted, a rainbow does not exist in a specific place. Everyone sees a rainbow based on where he's standing, where the sun is. If you go closer to it, you won't eventually reach it. You won't get the pot of gold that the leprechaun has put on the bottom of the rainbow. The rainbow will keep moving as you go, or you'll just stop seeing it. You will never be at or in the rainbow. A rainbow doesn't exist in a specific place, specific spot in space-time. It just kind of it's just a thing you see, which has to do with the light that reaches you from going through and bouncing off and being refracted by the drops in the water vapor in the air. You can, of course, see rainbows in other than after rain rainbows. You can see them in the mist and waterfalls. You can see them in a garden hose if you have. Again, the conditions have to be right. You have to have a light source. That has to be the right angle. Everything has to be correct. But basically, it is a relatively simple optical phenomenon. That's how we understand it today. Again, in the medieval period, in the classical Greek period, they did not understand it quite that way. But the key point, as we'll see from the various sources we quote, is that many of them also understood that it was a physical phenomenon. They had, some of them had empirical evidence. They knew that we could construct rainbows using glasses of water and other types of simple optical apparatuses. So they knew that this was something that could be reproduced by humans when the conditions are right. They saw that this was something, kind of the hallmark of modern science. You can reproduce it under predetermined conditions. That means there's a law operating here. It's not simply some kind of conscious communication from God. It's something about the way the world is designed. So this is kind of the background that the Jewish and possibly even earlier the Christian sources began to ask. So what exactly does the Torah mean when it tells us that the rainbow is a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So the first two, the two most famous of the early Jewish sources, are the Ramban and the Ben Ezra. The Ben Ezra has a characteristically terse comment on the matter, and somewhat equivocal comment too. He says, in source number one here, he says, Ilu hayinu ma'minim b'divrei chachmei Yavan. Were we to believe, to accept the assertions of the Greek philosophers that the rainbow is caused by the shining of the sun, that's what causes the rainbow, which is certainly what we believe too, in general terms. It comes by the shining of the sun. You can't see rainbows at night too. That's, you know, just more complicated, but basically it's from the shining of the sun. Then the Ben Ezra implies we would have to grapple with this question, what does the Torah mean? Yesh lomar, ki Hashem chizek or Hashemesh achar amabel. Hashem somehow intensified sunlight, intensified the power of the sun after the deluge, the Derech Nechon Olamev. The Ben Ezra seems to be taking for granted that when God says, Eskashi Nesati Ba'anan, the Torah clearly means that this is a new phenomenon, something which had not existed before, yet the Greeks are telling us that it is a simple optical phenomenon. The way to reconcile that is to argue that God actually changed some aspect of the laws of nature after the deluge. As we'll see, other commentators have offered other variations of this general theme that something changed about the laws of nature. The sun, the nature of clouds, the nature of optics, the nature of something. There are several variations on this theme, but the Ben Ezra is kind of the first and the simplest version of this family of approaches that the laws of physics are the laws of physics, but something about the nature of the sun, the nature of the light of the sun, changed after the deluge. Now, this, of course, creates a host of problems. We generally assume things about the constancy of nature, and I'm not going to get too far into arguments for or against, philosophically for or against, or in terms of evidence for the idea that there were fundamental changes in the cosmos or in basic features of our world. This is the Ibn Ezra's claim. He starts equivocally enough that if we believe what the Chachmei Yavan tell us, as though he's not sure, then he says this could be the explanation. Then he calls this Derech Nechona Lemaven. This is a correct approach for those who understand stuff. The Ramban is actually more emphatically convinced of the correctness of the Chachmei Yavan. If you look in the second paragraph in number 2, the Ramban begins, V'anachnu al karchenu namin l'divrei ha-yavan. We have no choice, the Ramban says, but to accept what the Greeks tell us. And the Ramban argues, as we alluded earlier, the Ramban argues that there are empirical reasons to accept what they tell us. He says we have to accept what they say, that sunlight creates rainbows when it hits mist or when it hits moist air. He says because if you take a receptacle holding water, place it before the sun, you can also see some kind of rainbow. So he argues again that empirically we see that rainbows are a naturalistic phenomenon, not some kind of special communication from God in connection with flooding and so on. The irony here is worth noting. In general, as we've discussed several times in the past, to kind of oversimplify things a little bit, if you were to ask yourself which of these is the more frum Rishon, which is the more traditionalist, more faithful to traditional beliefs, more quicker to dismiss non-Jewish approaches when they contradict our tradition, the Ramban generally is the one who we would call much firmer, so to speak. And the truth is, this point is actually acknowledged by the Akedas Yitzchak. You skip ahead to number 4 here. He kind of alludes to this in the first line of his comments. He says, Hinei HaRamban, Nisparsi Megidolei HaMaminim. The Ramban is not some kind of radical, free-thinking, heterodox thinker. The Ramban is Megidolei HaMaminim. He's from the greatest of believers. There's a line, I think, for Avraham Lichtenstein. Someone asked him, what does he think is the most important sefer, or the most important literary Torah treasure that the Jews have? I don't know exactly how the question was phrased, but he made some comment like, the Marna Vuchim, the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed, wonderful work, it's important, it's timeless, it's eternally, says, but if we didn't have the Marna Vuchim, life would go on, I could survive. And he says, the Ramban, if I didn't have the Ramban la Torah, I don't know what Judaism would look like, or something like that. But the Ramban has been held up for centuries as being is certainly, as the Akedah calls him, Gedolei HaMaminim, and many of his quarrels with Ibn Ezra, his Tochachas Magula, Va'ava Mesuteris, as he calls it, many of his quarrels essentially are critiques of Ibn Ezra for not being sufficiently differential toward the traditionalist view, toward the Ramban himself was a Kabbalist. Very often he explains things al pisod, as here he alludes to a sod about the rainbow too at the end of his comments. Nevertheless, here, ironically, he is less equivocal than the Ben Ezra. He is more full-throated in his acceptance of what they both call the Greek view of the rainbow, what we would call the scientific view of the rainbow, as being a naturalistic phenomenon. He says we have to accept it. Again, his argument is because of empirical experiments, whatever they are, they lead us to believe that the rainbow is a simple question of optics. The Ramban goes even further, and he argues that even a close reading of the biblical text will also support this idea that the rainbow is a simple optical phenomena, that the rainbow is not something new that was added after the deluge. The Ramban says that the wording of the Torah, Eskashti Nasati Ba'anan, I have placed, implying, as Zohar was saying earlier, that the Keshus is always there. The Ramban is not accepting the Ben Ezra's notion that the rainbow was something added to creation after the deluge. God was saying that the Keshes was always there. Now, Hashem was somehow saying the Keshes, which has always been there from the creation, now I am imputing, I'm somehow assigning new meaning to it. We'll discuss what that means, what he means by that in a moment.
Maybe maybe, you know, I think I learned a long time ago that like the ideal, like, bracha that Hashem would give us if it like rained at night, so like it wouldn't
work. Right.
So if it rained at night, you wouldn't have the sun to deal with and the keshet, you know. So maybe it wasn't that the rainbow wasn't ever there, it was that the water vapor wasn't ever there because it didn't rain during the day.
Yeah, so there certainly are approaches like that. As I said, the Ibn Ezra is kind of the first of a whole family of approaches that said that there was something different about a specific detail, not that the laws of physics changed, but that there was, or that one portion of the laws of physics changed, there was something specific that changed. That might be one further approach. As I said, we'll discuss further. There are a number of variations on this theme, different proposals by Rishonim and other commentators about what might have changed. Perhaps that would be another one. I don't remember if I saw that exact one, but perhaps that could be another possibility.
The laws of nature were suspended during the flood. That's correct.
There are such midrashim, yes.
Right. The midrash says that there was seasons equal, there was no season before
right.
The flood. There was no
accident.
So
you're making another point. Not only were they suspended during the flood, there are some implications of the commentators that things changed completely after the flood from the way they were before. Yeah, right. So that
the way the light hits the earth.
Yeah, I would have to. That I already have to get kind of weighed into the details and the actual math, which I didn't do. But perhaps there would be some way to explain that. Also, yeah, again, these ideas would all fall into the same family of approaches. That something about the world changed. God changed something about the world after the Mabul, either specifically for the Oz or just part of the post-Mabul reconfiguration of the world. That something changed, which resulted in rainbows, which is the Ibn Ezra, who's the beginning of this family of approaches. The Ramban is the first of the other family of approaches that the Keshet was always there. There was nothing new, actually, that happened after the Mabul. And Hashem was somehow taking the Keshet, which was there from Sheshet and Bereshit, and was using it now as an Os. What exactly does that mean? So the Ramban has a couple of very interesting biblical parallels. He quotes the example that Yaakov and Lavan, when they made Galed, they wanted to make a covenant that they would treat each other fairly and properly. They put some stones down. They said Eid HaGalazev, Eid HaMatzeva, and with Avimelech, they said, you know, I think we read this in Rosh Hashanah. We say Sheva Kvasos, the seven sheep, will be in Eidah, will be somehow testimonial to our covenants. The Ramban explains, not that anything would be changing in the future, but that this was a custom apparently. Something which was a specific object, which was set up in the context of, which was a sign meaning in the context of some kind of covenant, was called in biblical language an aid. That some feature of the world, we would just say, this will now henceforth be an aid. What exactly that means, I am not sure. But the Ramban is saying this was something that apparently they did, even if it wasn't something that was new. He says you can still say, Hashem was saying, from now on, I'm going to associate the keshes with my promise. When you see the keshes, you know, I'll remember. You'll remember whatever it is. So one of us somehow it'll be remembered the covenant, but it doesn't mean it was something new which would be coming down as a new thing. It just means that some feature of the world will now be associated with the covenant. Difficult to understand exactly what that means. You know, why do you need a feature if you're making a promise? It's not going to help you remember it. And Hashem doesn't need anything to remember. Still not really clear what the Ramban means, but you know, but with regard to our central question of what happened to the rainbow, the Ramban's inclination is that the rainbow was always there. The Ramban gives a couple of symbolic explanations for how the rainbow symbolizes God's mercy and forbearance. He says either because, you know, when you fire a bow, the curve of the bow faces convex away from you, concave toward you. That's how a bow works. So from God's perspective, the rainbow is upside down. A rainbow is always the two ends of the rainbow touch the earth, where the Irish think there are pots of gold, and the top of the rainbow is kind of backwards, so that it's like a hero who holds his bow backwards. He's showing peace, you know, no more fighting. Or he says the bow has no string. There's no string across the bow. It's an unstrung bow, so that shows that no more hostilities. So somehow the bow is a symbol. Exactly what it means, the Ramban is not entirely clear about, but at the end of the day, the Ramban then mentions that there is a sod nelam, a hidden sod, not just an ordinary sod, a hidden sod. But the Ramban alludes to Kabbalistic understandings too, but at least in terms of pshat, he takes a kind of more naturalistic, more modern perhaps, I don't know what you want to call it, approach to the rainbow. The rainbow is something that was always here. God is ascribing its symbolic meaning here. Perhaps, again, as Dora was saying before, I don't know if the Ramban is saying this, but you can always suggest that the Hashem meant he designed the world in such a way initially that rainbows would be a feature. But be that as it may, the Ramban understands that that rain was, the rainbows were always there, and that somehow they're nevertheless being harnessed here as an oath for God's promise of future forbearance, no more Mabels. Now, we mentioned earlier that the Akedas Yitzchak and the Amar Brunel, both contemporaries, both a lot of overlap between them, they both spend a lot of ink. They both have many column inches grappling with this question of what exactly happened in the rainbow. Did anything change? Weren't there always rainbows? I want to focus a little bit specifically on the Akedas comments, because he has some remarkable things to say in the general question of science and Torah, which are not widely quoted, but are some truly fascinating comments here. The Akedah on Parshas Noach, he begins by noting that the Ramban is Migidolei HaMaminim and still said we have no choice but to accept the naturalistic explanation of rainbows. He said he had no choice. He had to accept that which was true based on Me'anisayon, based on empirical evidence, and so on. Then the Akedah goes on and says that this idea that we have to accept what science tells us, even if it's not necessarily Pashup Shayin on the Psukim and Parshas Noach, this is what he calls the Musar HaYashar Asher Kasavnu B'Psichem V'Piachachem B'Sefer HaPal. This is the Musar Yashar, the correct and upright Musar, which we have cited in an introduction to his Sefer from the Chacham, from the scholar in the Sefer HaPal. The Chacham in question is, I have an English translation in number 9, it is Abu Hamid Muhammad ibn Muhammad al-Ghazali. I don't know what his mother or his kids called him exactly. He's generally referred to as al-Ghazali. The book in question is, the Akedah calls it Sefer HaPala. It is, in English, it is typically translated as The Incoherence of the Philosophers. The al-Ghazali was actually a fairly frum guy, apparently, by those medieval standards. He wrote his Sefer, his book, as a refutation of free-thinking philosophers. On the whole, he spent a lot of time lecturing, from a religious perspective, lecturing the rationalists, the philosophers, for their hubris, for their assumptions that they know everything, for their dismissive attitude toward religion. He was a believing, pious Muslim. But nevertheless, you know, like some of his Jewish contemporaries, like some of the Jewish medieval thinkers, he did have some use for philosophy. He was willing to engage them on their own terms. So he wrote this book called, I forget the Arabic title, but called Sefer HaPala, The Incoherence of the Philosophers. Some of the philosophers who were not pleased by this wrote a refutation to his book with the great title called The Incoherence of the Incoherence, arguing that his book was incoherent. But nevertheless, he was a somewhat philosophical but believing and faithful Muslim. Nevertheless, he was not interested in people who were being too frum about it, who were being too unthinking in their taking everything literally and rejecting science and just being too fundamentalist. He didn't have patience for the real fundamentalists. So if you read the passage in number 9, he says it's ridiculous. People who think it's their religious duty to believe nonsense, he says, not only is it nonsense, you're not being fair to religion, he says, things that have been established by astronomical and mathematical evidence that leave no room for doubt, he says, you tell people they have to believe things that are against astronomy, that are against math, they'll just laugh at you, and they'll, he says, you make basically what we would call a chilul Hashem, you're making religion seem silly and childish, he says. He says, and... Then he has a great line, which the Akedah likes. He says, greater harm is done to religion by an immethodical helper than by an enemy whose actions, however hostile, are yet regular. For, as the proverb goes, I'm not sure whose proverb, but as the proverb goes, a wise enemy is better than an ignorant friend. As the Akedah quotes it, an oyev chacham is better than an ohev sachal, or an oyev ksil. So the Akedah is briefly invoking this in the context of the rainbow, the people who are insisting that the rainbow is some kind of magical signal from Hashem and is not to be understood optically, Akedah's arguing is silly. And just want to digress for a while now, the original context of both al-Ghazali and the Akedah in his introduction, the original context was about eclipses. There are comments both in Chazal and in the Quran, apparently, that talk about the eclipse as being an evil sign, an omen of ill fortune, a portent of doom and of trouble. And there's such a statement in Chazal. There's also such a statement in Muhammad apparently said such a thing. The top of the second page, that Akedah brings the Gemara in Sukkah that says, Al Dalad Varam Ma'oros Lokim, there are four things which cause the celestial bodies, the Ma'oros, the luminous bodies, to be Lokim, to be eclipsed, to be blackened, different types of sins and Averis. So the Akedah says, taking this Chazal at face value, that that eclipses are, you know, not scheduled or kind of punishments from Hashem, not part of the regular programming of the universe. Akedah says this is silly. Mavur Habitul, he calls it sheker. He says Akedahs can be predicted, they can be calculated. He says we know what time it is, we can figure, we can calculate using our astronomical models, whatever they are. He says they have nothing to do with chet. He says we can't argue that they're a direct response to chet. He says, and again, like Al-Ghazali says, Ein mitznai ha-tarani, it is not a condition of Torah faith to believe shkarim for samim, to believe obvious falsehoods, and to make up stuff in order to explain Pashup Shadim Sukkim, he says, can't do that. Hu ha'inyin ba'atmo kasva chacham Al-Ghazali, it's exactly what Al-Ghazali says. Srichim l'kabla emes misha amro, famous language of the Rambam. He might not have been Jewish, but we have to accept Al-Ghazali's point because he's correct. And therefore, obviously, Chazal were not fools. Chazal were great and wise men. Obviously, according to him, the only solution is to look for deeper and more subtle meanings in what Chazal meant. I'm not going to get into right now what exactly he thinks Chazal meant by the comments about eclipses, but in general, he says that certainly we can't be required to accept things that contradict astronomy, that contradict math, and therefore both in the regard with regard to the rainbow and with regard to eclipses, we have to follow this dictum of Al-Ghazali, and we have to look for other more subtle and more sophisticated meanings in the biblical passages and in the comments of Chazal. Now, there are various discussions. You know, the fact that eclipses are predictable, are calculable, was, of course, known for quite some time. The most delicious account of in Jewish sources of the predictability, the calculability of eclipses is a passage in a work called Sefer Abris. Sefer Abris was a fascinating and wildly popular, very charming work written in the 18th century by a man named Rabbi Pinchas Elio Horowitz. He was a European, lived in Lithuania much of his life, Galicia. He was, again, not a maskil, not a rationalist, not a free thinker, a very traditional Kabbalist, I think, very traditional Jew, but he was just enthralled, enamored by science, by progress, by the new great reports coming out of exploration, of science. I remember reading his account of a balloon flight across Europe. He was just fascinated by the progress of science and the knowledge and technology of his time. Sefer Abris apparently was wildly popular, published several dozen times. Basically, Sefer Abris is, from a Jewish perspective, is just a kind of accounts of, all mixed together with Torah, but accounts of science, of modern science, not in any kind of systematic way. He has no agenda. He has no real grand philosophical program, but it's just been called an encyclopedia of science from a Torah perspective, just a kind of, you know, almost with a childlike sense of wonder of the science and the technology and the explorations that were going on in his time. We last encountered the Sefer Abris several months ago, first encountered, I guess, in our shiurim, where we were discussing the halachic approaches to microscopic things and bugs and so on, microbes. The Sefer Abris, Rabbi Horowitz, was one of the first to discuss the new discoveries, the Dutch fellow who invented the lenses and stuff, and they began to discover all the creepy crawlies in every drop of water. And what does halacha say about these things? He was one of the first to write about this. So he has an account, which I didn't reproduce in the handout because it's rather long. I just want to read a little bit of it because it's extremely charming. He has an account of Captain James Cook's first voyage to Tahiti to observe the transit of Venus of 1769. He refers to this as, he refers to a couple of eclipses that happened in The Hague, he saw one, and in Lita. Then he says, there was once what he calls also Likui HaShemesh, an occlusion or an obstruction of the sun, by Venus, Kochav Noga, the morning star, Hanikra Panus, Venus. He says, later he tells you what year it was. It was in the year Tufkuf Chavtes. This was the transit of Venus of 1769. He says, this was predicted years earlier, he says, by the Beis Medrash HaChachma Hanikra Universitat, the Beis Medrash of Wisdom, which was called University in England, he says. Haley and others had predicted the transit years in advance. Something like a 243-year cycle. It happens 8 years apart, and then 100-something years apart, and then another 100-something years apart. Very regular thing where Venus passes in front of the sun. He explains to you that even though Venus is the very bright star, it's extremely bright, the morning star, the evening star, here it seems like a black dot because, like the moon, he says, it's reflecting the sun's light. So when the sun shines on it, it's really bright. When it passes in front of the sun, then it's just a black dot because it itself is not a light-emitting body. So He doesn't even explain why, but the transit of Venus was apparently a big deal for various scientific purposes. They wanted to, it helped them calculate longitude, it helped them calculate the astronomical unit, the difference between the Earth and the Sun. Basically, to the extent that I understand it, if you have Venus passing between the Earth and the Sun and you observe it from two or preferably several different places widely spaced on the Earth's surface, you have a kind of triangle between, let's say, England, Tahiti, all over there, and the Sun. You form a triangle. The question of where Venus is going to pass through on this leg of the triangle, it's going to be at a slightly different time than where it will pass through on this leg. By carefully observing it in all the different places and getting good records and exact times of where it passes, you can measure the length of the various legs of the triangle. You can learn about what longitude the different observatories are at. You can learn about how far away the Earth is from the Sun. This was a big deal. The English Admiralty, I think, allocated several thousand pounds for this voyage. And they commissioned James Cook, who was a legend. He was both a great captain. He was good with maps. He was a good cartographer. He was an astronomer. He knew how to lead men. He was good under conditions of adversity, as they say. He was eventually killed on a later voyage by Hawaiian indigenous peoples in Hawaii. But he was, you know, he had quite the life. So as the Sefer Ebrith describes his voyage to Tahiti, the first voyage of James Cook, doesn't name him, but he says he traveled there. He says they left England, they traveled to a Medina Rechoka Ma'od, a very faraway land, Me'ever Liyam, B'tzi Adir, on a great ship. We know it as the famous HMS Endeavor, a voyage of an entire year. He says this: they traveled to an island, Asher Me'ie Hayam, Anikra, Atahaita, what we call Tahiti, Asher Medina's America, he calls it. They took a year-long voyage to set up an observatory on Tahiti, and that is where they measured the transit. And sure enough, he says, triumphantly, the European scholars were correct. It happened exactly when they predicted it, and I guess it enabled them to do their stuff. His point is not the longitude or the astronomical unit. His point just is that you see how wonderful the science is. They can predict these things accurately in advance, years in advance, and so on. This was a great triumph, he says, of European science. Now, he mentions one curious little story, he says. He says there was a great crisis that was almost averted. He says they arrived a day or two early, or I don't know how early they arrived. They set up their equipment, all their measuring equipment, the night before. The natives apparently stole some of their instruments. He says they stole the telescope, and another source says it was actually a quadrant that they stole. He says, well, he says it here, they had Kliha Bata Hanikrin Farin Glazer, optical instruments that are called Farin Glazer, far glasses, glasses that allow you to see far away, which sound like telescopes. Asher Hamtziu Chachme Dioptica, that were invented by the scholars of Dioptica, which I suppose is optics of some sort. So he says, the natives, he said, on Tahiti, they saw these equipment, according to the account, that one account I read, the Europeans were guarding them carefully because these were expensive and delicate equipment. The natives thought they must be, you know, great magic in there, so they stole them. They got them back, though, and they were thankfully able to measure their astronomy, and great joy was experienced by all, and they had, at least this voyage ended happily ever after, they measured their transit properly. Now, the Sefer Ebrith goes on and mentions a very curious religious point. He says that through this ability, that through this reliable and calculable predictability of eclipses, we actually can win, he says, and we won an important religious victory. We and the Christians, the Judeo-Christian faiths, won an important victory over the Chinese, he says. The Chinese, he claims, had dynastic records, historical records, going back many thousands of years, far, far, far earlier than the 5,776 that we have, 77 that we have now. And they claim that they had accurate records, king after king, dynasty after dynasty. They had accurate records going back far beyond the point at which we claim Bries HaOlam occurred. Says Rabbi Horowitz, the science of eclipses can enable us to conclusively refute their accounts. Why? Because they, in their accounts, describe eclipses that occurred throughout their dynastic records. Says Rabbi Horowitz, all the accounts that occurred in real history, the last 5,000 years or so, are accurate. We can measure them. We should note that when we talk about predicting astronomical events going forward, it works, of course, in both directions. Certainly, classical physics, classical mechanics, maybe even contemporary, that's more complicated. Certainly, Newtonian mechanics worked equally in the forward direction of time as in the reverse. You can simply run your equations backwards, and time doesn't particularly care whether you want to run it forward or backward. You can predict an eclipse tomorrow, you can predict an eclipse yesterday, and indefinitely as far back as you would like to go. So the Sefer Ebris says, we can calculate the history of eclipses back as far as we go. The Chinese records, he says, all the eclipses they assert are accurate 4 or 5,000 years or so. All the ones that they claim occurred before 5,000 years are erroneous, are bogus. This shows that their records are bogus for the period before 5,000 years. Now, obviously, this doesn't prove that the world is 5,000 years old. The fact that their records are made up or are full of errors from that period, that all that shows that their records are wrong. It doesn't prove anything positively about when Bria Se'olam occurred, but it does, he says, refute their records. I poked around a little bit. I'm not an expert on history or the history of eclipses, but his basic point seems to be correct in that there are few, if any, reliable records of eclipses before about 1,000 or maybe 2,000 years before the Common Era. That doesn't mean they didn't occur. That doesn't mean we just don't know. The cultures that left useful, reliable, meaningful written records that have enough dating and enough context for us to put into historical accurate, to date them chronologically, the records that we have do not, there is no reliable account of an eclipse from before 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. So that much is apparently true. I don't know what Chinese dynastic records the Sefer Bris is referring to, but whatever they were, if they actually claimed accurately and verifiably claims about when eclipses occurred 10,000 years ago, there either are no such claims or they are wrong. There apparently are no known records of these phenomena before about 3,000 or 4,000 years ago.
So if you go back before the Mabul, the tides could have been completely
okay. So you're saying certainly the accumulation of natural stochastic processes plus the Mabul, which was an extraordinary event, maybe that could throw off.
The eclipses would have occurred at the right time, but in the wrong place.
Okay, so I guess you'd have to see whether the records they gave were right, where the times were more or less correct, or the places were wrong, or the times were also wrong. I don't know. Yeah, sorry, right. So that's a good point. Yeah, so I don't know. So, just to kind of wrap things up, one or two final points about this. Returning to rainbows for a few moments. So we mentioned that there are basically two families of approaches. There are those who argue that rainbows indeed didn't exist before the Mabul, either as the Ben Ezra says, because there was something about the sun, that the intensity of the sun increased, or the version of the Ran, the Drushus Haran. He has a version of the process, the way he explains it. He says it was something about the water. The water used to be denser or less permeable, or again, what this means in a modern sense, I can't tell you. But he seems to pin the thing on the water. It used to be that the sun didn't penetrate the water as much as it did now. Now the water became somehow more amorphous and more permeable, and that's why, again, these are all, and other people here suggested other possibilities, these are all kind of one family of approaches that say that that there was something about physics that changed after the Mabul. The other family of approaches is the one begun by the Ramban that assumes that rainbows always existed, but somehow still there was something symbolic about rainbows, which Hashem was ascribing some symbolism, or as Dvara said it, that the world was created the way to begin with, to have rainbows to be somehow a siman for us that there will not be any more Mabuls. I want to turn just briefly to a couple of halachas about rainbows. There aren't that many. There are essentially two halachas about rainbows, which, as you might suspect, actually are in a bit of conflict with each other. One halacha about the rainbow is that you make a bracha on the rainbow. In Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Reish Chaf Tes, in Aruch Chaim, there is a bracha you make on the rainbow, Zochar Abris, V'neman Bebriso, etc., that you make a bracha when you see a rainbow. There is another halacha, sort of a halacha, I guess, not sure what it is, that you are not supposed to look at a rainbow. The Gemara in Chagiga says that both you shouldn't, there's an injunction against looking at a rainbow, that it's considered you're disrespectful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It says you actually can suffer from it. Ain of Kehos, you can, your eyesight can dim. So the Rishonim already began to ask, if you're not supposed to look at it, how do you make a bracha when you see it? Now, I guess you can see it by accident. You can just kind of see it, and then before you have a chance to look away. Nevertheless, the Rosh, the Tur, and this is kind of the mainstream approach that's taken. They raise the question. They point out the language of Chazal when they say don't look at the rainbow. So in English, we say look. We have many words for look. We say look. We say gaze. We say stare. Ogle. You can find lots of different words. And in Hebrew also, we have a number of different words for look. You know, the two of the common ones in Hebrew are, the most common one is re'iyah, ro'eh. There's also a word that you find often in rabbinic literature. The word is mistakel, histakel. So histakel seems to have a connotation of more of an intense looking, a deliberate gaze, staring or something. So the mainstream approach taken is that the language is haro'es akeshes. If you see the rainbow, you make the bracha. But you shouldn't be mistakel in the keshes, which is understood by the Rosh and the Tur, the Vilna Gaon, and others to mean you can see a rainbow briefly, but you shouldn't stare and look at it very carefully and probe it too carefully. The language of the Rosh, as cited by the Abu Draham, is Ein Mistakel Keroa. Hamistakel, the Mistakel is a greater level of vision. It's Mosif, Umedaktek Babatasso. You look more, you look carefully. Some posts can focus on the more, how long you look at it. Some posts can focus more on the how carefully and intently you look at it. But this is, I think, the mainstream approach. Mishnah Berurah, the Shulchan Aruch seems to indicate this, that you can look at the rainbow, but you shouldn't stare and ogle it too closely. This is a distinction which has application in a number of other areas of halacha. Perhaps the most charged and the most kind of practical or common one is with regard to men and women. Halacha is that men are not supposed to be mistakel at women. So again, you know, we all understand that there's a degree of staring and of ogling which is not appropriate. And we all understand also that most of us do look at people of the opposite gender. So the basic distinction that the post can pretty much agree is somewhere along this continuum. Roa is okay, mistakel is not. Exactly where you cross the line from roa to mistakel is, it's tricky. But the same basic distinction is what they suggest about the rainbow, that you can look at it, but you shouldn't be mistakel at the rainbow. Again, the Gemara is not very clear why not. The Gemara says it's disrespectful somehow to God. Exactly how it's disrespectful, the commentators offer various approaches, which I haven't reproduced there. Some more mystical, some more philosophical. I don't think I saw any that I understood particularly well, so I'm not going to get into that. But I didn't look too carefully at that. But there is this idea. There is this rule that you are not supposed to look, stare too closely at the rainbow. That brings us to the last point I'm going to mention. One of the last halachas in conjunction with the rainbow is if you do see a rainbow and you make the bracha, should you then tell all your friends, look, there's a rainbow, come out and take a look and make the bracha on it? So some achronim said you should not. Since the rainbow is a sign of averted doom, it's a sign of God's, we're escaping because of God's promise, but we really deserve a dire fate. Some say it's a matter of shame or of doom. It's motzei diba. You shouldn't go around chattering about such things. The Mishnah Berurah actually adopts this approach. The Mishnah Berurah cites this in the name of the Chai Adam, who cites it curiously in the name of a sefer whose name he can't remember. Sefer Echad Shmo Nela Mimeni, that you shouldn't tell people about it. Mishnah Berurah seems to accept this. Other posts can disagree. The Achronim bring the Sefer Bris Kahuna, who says the minog here in the community of Djerba, North Africa, that on the contrary, anyone who sees a rainbow goes and tells his friends, multiple friends, and the Chai Adam is not correct, he says. He says, first of all, he says, we're happy. We're happy that Hashem saved us. We're happy that we benefited from God's grace and that his favor. He's not wiping us out. We owe thanks to Kosh Baruch Hu for that. Or he says, on the more somber note, he says, we should remember that that we did something wrong and that we might be deserving of destruction. It's a go to tshuva. So for either of those reasons, he says that the minhag was actively to tell, and he endorses the minhag. He says, Yafa Nagu Po Lahagid. He thinks the minhag is correct. I saw an article by Rabbi Eliezer Melamed, one of the leading Dati Lumi sages in Eretz Yisrael, who says he thinks that's the minhag today too. So again, for Ashkenazim at least, the Mishnah Berurah doesn't bring a dissenting view, says you shouldn't tell. Some of the Sfardim, at least, the Kaf HaChaim apparently brings the, in Iraq, brings the Chai Adam, but the Bris Kahuna in Djerba says not. Rosie Malamud says not. I don't know if there is a dominant custom. Certainly I have seen rainbows and I have told other people to come look at them because they're really neat. I don't know if that was correct or not. I don't know if there is a clear minhag, but there are these dissenting views about whether one should actively tell someone else about a rainbow that he has seen.